Hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled Rhinestone Busboys Are My Only Friend. And it's about... What is it about? I don't know. It's about the works, creative output of Brooke Prigor and Jake McKelvey?
That's right.
Oh, I did it right! Yes, I nailed it! First try. Yes, and so our guests are those people. And I guess, I don't know how you want to introduce yourselves or what?
Hi, my name's Brooke. My name's Brooke Pridemore. That's me. Nice to meet you. We've met many times, but
we've met many times. But you have things are happening. I mean, let's get the hard sell right out the door right away.
I've got a record coming out that I've kind of been talking about for a long time. Dude. Called "Metal Is My Only Friend." It comes out on November 9th on my own record label called Brooke Pridemore Industries. And pre-orders are available now at brookpridemore.bandcamp.com. It's record number 6 from me. I played almost all the instruments on it myself, and I'm extraordinarily proud of. I did all the artwork too. If there was a way I could have pressed the vinyl myself, just like rended the plastic, you know, I melted. I don't know what kind of plastic. They say virgin vinyl. Mm-hmm. Have you seen that as a tag? Have you seen it anywhere as a tag? That's fucking bullshit. You know that, right? Like, there's no such thing. There's no such thing as virgin vinyl because it's plastic. So, you know, but I can say it's on 180 gram virgin vinyl, and you know, it's like saying something's an all beef patty. It doesn't mean anything. An all-beef patty from McDonald's has like 20% beef in it.
Yeah.
Because all the beef that they use is real beef. But then the rest of it is soy.
Yes.
So, you can get my record on an all-beef patty.
Virgin
soy
vinyl.
Soy marinated in beef tallow. Where the grooves fit perfectly. And anytime they pick up dust, it distorts the quality of the... But that makes it your copy.
Yes, and it's somehow more endearing and,
I bought a copy of, I found the tag team album, Woomp, There It Is.
Mm.
Not the single, but the album. And I got so excited, I paid like $10 for it. I got it home and Woomp, There It Is fucking skips. And not like in a way that it's like it chips once, it fast forwards like 10 seconds every time it goes around. So it's just utterly useless. So mad.
Oh.
For a moment, I thought I had the best terrible record in history.
And it's even worse now. It's more terrible than...
I think the original classic Woomp, There It Is by Tag Team is a masterpiece. I mean, it should be in the Louvre, you know, but I can understand. Actually, sitting there and listening to it on vinyl, once it actually started playing, I'm like... The whole song isn't really as great as I thought it was. It's not.
It's a great chorus, though. The chorus is amazing.
It's true.
But, and of course, in Jake, as he takes a sip of coffee, I thought it's a teacher move. You just call on them, you know, when they're not looking at their phone. That's, hey, what do you think? So, I know the thing's old, but you have...
My latest endeavor is a little EP I did called The Rhinestone Busboy, which is it's my first solo release. I play with a band called The Countertops, and we have a couple of full lengths, and I did this busboy thing as sort of an interim release between full band, full lengths, but it kind of ended up being treated more as a proper thing as time went on, but... So that's kind of my latest thing, and I'm from Massachusetts, but I just moved to Brooklyn a few months ago, and so Brooke and I are pseudo neighbors now.
Although you live in Bay Ridge and I live in Bed-Stuy, which is about as not neighbors as you can get and still be in the borough. If you lived in the flatlands, right, that would be a little farther, but it's pretty far.
It definitely is.
I wanted to ask you, how do you like living in, what does living in Brooklyn in 2018 feel like for the first time?
Well, it's weird because the area that we moved to, Bay Ridge, is so not the Brooklyn that I think people my age flock to typically. It's a much more family-oriented place. And that alone feels a little bit interesting because it's like seems kind of like not the place that I would have been expected to end up, but it's also kind of nice for that reason. I was very self-conscious about moving to Brooklyn just because I didn't want to be another white dude with a guitar moving to Brooklyn. And so I felt kind of weird about the whole situation, but I'm pretty happy with how we landed.
That's cool.
But we're definitely far away.
I'm in this position, you know, I live like kind of right at the corner of like entitled and douchebag, you know, like right at the intersection.
Mm-hmm.
And 5 years ago, I've lived in my neighborhood for a vague neighborhood for like 11 years. And, you know, 5 years ago when I moved into the place that I'm in now, you know, living right at that intersection meant that I was 3 blocks from Silent Barn. I was 3.5 blocks from Palisades. I was a block from Goodbye Blue Monday. I was 15, 20 minutes from 10 other venues. And none of those places are there anymore. Like, no, they're all gone. And they haven't been replaced by... There are places to play, but they haven't been replaced by, like, these central hub kind of places. So I don't really feel in my neighborhood, like, unless you hang out in bars, and I don't hang out in bars just to go into a bar, you know. I don't really feel in my neighborhood like there's anything particularly central about where I live anymore either. Like, mm-hmm. Everything is kind of a destination. Like, you have to have... This year I've been to a lot of shows, but, like, you have to have a ticket. You have to have a ticket to go see, you know... The kind of, like I went and saw Sleep, and so New York is a very good place, like, if you want to buy a $20 or more ticket to see something, but it's not really the kind of place where you can like, sort of stumble into a crazy show anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Like that, and I think that I want to believe that's what people have been flocking to Brooklyn to have, and it's not there anymore. I don't know what's going to replace it,
right?
But
which, for both of you then, as creators, like, what does that do, you know, the necessity of having, like, I don't know, that kind of infrastructure or those kind of platforms to do work in?
Sure.
That's something, I mean, you know, I don't think what's happening in Pittsburgh is on the same scale, but there are, you know, things happening in Pittsburgh where... You know, where you guys are playing tonight, I know they're in the middle of a 3-year lease, but I always, like, I'll have these random thoughts, like, oh, God, what's going to happen to Roboto if Garfield gets fully gentrified?
Is that neighborhood on the...
I think it is. I think there's not too much land left in the East End. And what I mean by East End is basically between the two rivers, still in city limits.
Yeah.
A lot of the low-hanging fruit has already been plucked. And so people who can't afford Squirrel Hill, Shadyside, this neighborhood, Bloomfield, Lawrenceville, Libby. Sorry. We have a dog now. We have a podcast dog. Her name's Libby. And she's just going to bark in your earbuds. Those places have all been kind of plucked up. And so what's next? And I think Garfield is one of the what's next. It's nice that there's storefronts in stores in the storefronts by Roboto now. There was not 3 years ago, but yeah. Then at some point is somebody going to say there's gold in that building.
Right. Well, for me, when I moved to New York, I moved to the city in 2002. There were so many options. Mm. That it took me a year to find... it took me a year of like diligently trying to find my way to this place in the East Village called Sidewalk. And I found Sidewalk, and then I made that my place. You know, I made that like there, and the way I did that was 5, 6, 7 nights a week, I was there. When I'd get out of work, I'd just go right down there, and whatever was going on, I'd be there for it. And then eventually they start going like, you must play shows too, right? And then like you started to be accepted into their into their little thing. And so for a time, New York for me was central around this one room. And I thought that my creative drive relied on on that room to fuel it. Mm-hmm. I spent a lot of time kind of foolishly ignoring other scenes. Mm. You know, the whole Captured Tracks thing, the whole Blank Dogs, all those, you know, mid to late aughts bands were doing very well in that era, and I was completely unaware of it until after it was all over. Because I thought New York music meant this one room, you know. Yeah. Tom Petty would come to play New York every year, I'm sure, and he was never concerned about what was happening at the Sidewalk.
Yeah.
You know. But eventually over time, the urgency to be there faded, and the need, you know, there's nothing wrong with that scene or any of the people in it, but the need for it to be in one room faded for me. And I have never found that I can go this place and I'll know that I'm at home. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been fired from that bar 3 times over the years. I think that's probably a record, you know. So I've never found that spot where I just knew I was going to play once a month, and I knew I was going to, you know, I knew exactly what it was going to look like. And so over the last, like, really since about 2011, it's been this, like, I've had to unlearn that thinking where, you know, where I identified with a room and with a space, and I was like, okay, I've got to make whatever room I walk into my space. I've got to walk into any room assuming that, you know, when we played at the place in Allentown, the Coffee House Without Limits last night, I have to walk into that coffee shop and assume that the people there, that there's an unwritten contract that the people there are going to let me do my thing for 30, 35 minutes. That for that, a lot of the amount of time, that space belongs to me. Mm-hmm. So with the urgency of, like, I really like Roboto. We're playing there tonight. I think it's a really cool room.
Yeah.
If it goes away, there will be shows elsewhere. I mean, eventually.
Yeah.
It's not like the show space goes away and there's no place to have shows anymore. Like, people work it out. You know, human beings are almost as tenacious as the cockroach. You know, we find a way to make it work. You find a way to make art. So it is weird to see. It is weird to hear that neighborhood is becoming something that it was not, you know, 5, 10 years ago. I remember when I played there in 2007. It was in a different space, but
yeah, it was by that diner last time we met up.
Crazy.
It was literally around the corner. I should have just walked you over there and said, "Hey, do you remember that abandoned storefront?"
Crazy.
Yeah,
I'd love. I would never have found that place again. So I don't know if that answers your question.
I think that does well. I mean, I guess for Jake, I mean, how do you negotiate? It's not like you weren't ever in Brooklyn before, but, you know, this... Because, you know, listening to both of you talk, too, is I'm reminded of... I think there was that Tom Wolfe quote once I heard him say about New York. It's like, you don't move to New York City for the quality of life, because it's actually quite low, but it's like you move there to make things happen or be in the proximity of people who make things happen, who, you know, and that energy. Hmm. And I guess, what does it mean for you to sort of, like, as an artist, a performing artist, to create a new home base?
Yeah, it's interesting because I feel like I've never really lived in a place that was a proper... that had a proper sort of local scene necessarily. because I pretty much went from, I'm from central Massachusetts, so I'm not next to Boston, I'm near Worcester. And I lived in Keene, New Hampshire for a few years, which is a college town, which places like that have their own little insular scenes that exist, but they center around the 4-year span of the kids who come and go. And yeah. So that's where my band started, and we played a whole lot of shows there, but it's, you know, there's no permanence to that, because yeah. everyone that you're playing to is going to be gone soon, you know. And so then I pretty much went from there to live back in Central Mass for a bit, and then moved to New York, where you would think there is sort of that option, that opportunity to sort of do something like what Brooke was saying, of kind of establish a home base and be able to sort of identify more with kind of a local scene. And it's hard to say how that will look for me, because I've only been living there for a few months, so I haven't done a whole lot of it yet. But yeah, I don't know, because we have come down to New York to play a bunch of times mm-hmm. over the years, and we started off just doing your standard backroom bar, you know, $10 cover and no one shows up type of shows, and we've done a bunch of those, and then we kind of found our way into some of the DIY stuff a little bit in the last couple of years, but a lot of that, like Brooke was saying, is no longer in existence. So it's that, coupled with the fact that I you know, like we're talking about, live kind of far away from where all this stuff does or did exist, makes it interesting to you know, sort of plot out what that might look like for me in terms of trying to be a person who plays in New York.
You can't just like walk down the street. Like, if you want to go to a show, it's an excursion.
Exactly.
You've got to really put some energy into
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Which is okay, but it would be nice to have that, it's, you know, it's just a 5-minute walk, I'll pop in type of feeling. It's definitely not something we have where I am. But, so yeah, I guess I do, in some ways, I've longed for the sort of the feeling of being one, like one of those bands who, you know, gets to open up a show for like a bigger band coming to town or whatever. We've never lived in a place where that was even a thing, because they just weren't the types of places where that stuff happened. So that's something I've wondered about, if we've if we've missed chances to do things we could have otherwise done if we did live in Boston, or if we lived in a place where there was, like, you know, kind of more of a trend of bigger bands come touring through. And so I don't know, I mean, it is what it is, but I've also always kind of put a little bit more stock into the notion of being a touring act. I think that maybe holds a little more weight. I don't know if that's true or not, but
I played a show in Detroit. I'm from Detroit. I played a show there a few years ago, and this on the wall, somebody had been like, it was like Warriors, Screaming Females, something, or it was like some, these three like marquee, you know, for punk rock, marquee acts on this one bill. And I was like, wow, that bill is that's insane. Like, I don't know. I don't even remember which bands they were, but they were these bands that was like, wow, in this place, you know. And the kid doing the show was like, you know, if you moved to Detroit, you could open for those kind of shows all the time. And it was like, I don't know if I buy that. Like, I don't know if I buy that I could just, like, I feel like anywhere you go, there's 100 people begging for the opportunity to open. Mm-hmm. You know, that kind of thing. So, missed opportunities, sure, but, like, you know, what's really a missed opportunity in theory? It's
right.
Something that wasn't intended to happen. I'm not, I get where you're, you know. Sometimes I'm like, I look at bands and I'm like, you know, I saw this band open for the Dead Milkmen, and I was like, oh, that's fucking great, you know, like, there must be this big band. And then I booked them on a show, and like nobody came, because you go from like playing first in a sold out room to to like just there's just no translation between. So I don't even know what that's worth, you know.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah, it's kind of worth whatever happens in the moment that you're doing it, but whether it. I don't think it necessarily propels you. It's right. There's no real like ladder you're climbing of. We got this opening slot. So, guess what's next? I don't think that really happens.
We'll be at. We'll be at Duff's. You know, tomorrow.
Well, I mean, I think you know, and I kind of like pressing on this because you know it is. The world's full of talented people. I think that's one of the things I know listening to other people talk about this or viewing other people's struggles or even my own somewhat. It is this question of like there's people doing fantastic things. It's like how does one kind of get out there or make sense of, you know, maybe this new landscape where, and I know I've said this a lot in the podcast, where, you know, recorded music has very little to no recorded monetary value. And yeah, I mean, did gentrification, if you live in an urban center where things are supposed to happen, sort of displaces venues. And it's like, it's refreshing to hear people thinking about, and maybe this could be, I don't know if this is necessarily we want to think about, like, what's the advice you have? But in a way, I think we're having that discussion for people who are talented people who want to express themselves, want to play out, want to do their thing. You know, how do you break through that barrier? I mean, there's somebody, I can just say anecdotally, there's somebody I know who is a fantastic musician who, you know, doesn't play out, you know, is, and it's just this weird thing of like, well, I don't know how to do that. And it's like, I don't know. Like,
yeah, it's like, how do you make sense? Start by going to shows.
Yeah.
Personally, start by going to shows and then take it from there. You know, it's like, it's funny. Now I'm like, I don't go to open mics. Actually, last night was my first show and like, it had been like 40 days since I played. And really like 40 days since I had even picked up the guitar. Like I don't. And I've been doing a little bit of like, getting the brain is going again about writing but I really like took a conscious break from like purposefully took a break from playing for a little while because I had the opportunity and but I do still go to open mics once in a while just to like see what's going on and try to see if there's anything you know any new relationships to forge or anything and you'll meet people and like young performers will be like how do I get started or I want to start a band how do I get people to be in my band you know or like how do I get shows and I've come to this thing where I'm like where I tell people like do something by yourself that's compelling enough that people want to be a part of it with you. You know, if you want to be, I operate the way I do, you know, I made this, we did this, you know, mostly as like a solo act so when I want to make a record where I play the drums, I can just do it, you know, and I knew that a long time ago where like, I didn't want to be in a democratic society, of songs. Like I wanted complete control over them. And so, I had to learn how to make something on my own that was compelling enough to get people into a room. And I don't always get people into a room. It's not always a banger, you know. It's not always, you know. I don't think anybody's... I was reading this list of, like, the most under-attended shows of all time. And you're like, Beyonce played a show in South Africa or something, and, like, 25 people watched the show, you know, in a stadium. And so you go, like, it happens to everybody, you know?
Yeah.
But more and more, it's like, you know, your MO can't be, well, I need to get on the big show so I make the big money, so I make the big, you know, so I get the next big show, so I don't have to pay rent, so I don't have to...
Yeah.
Like, that Keith Richards thing is gone, you know?
Yeah.
We all watch... Derek and I, we watched that documentary, that Keith Richards documentary, and he sits down, and he's got a guitar handler. So he just sits down and goes like this, and the guitar guy just puts the guitar in his hand. You know, and he travels everywhere with this semi-trailer full of thousands of guitars. That just, like... That's not gonna happen. It's just not gonna happen, and that's not the bar for success.
Yeah.
It's not like if you shoot and you land lower than that bar that you've failed.
Yeah.
In my opinion, you know, like you want to have an audience, so you have to strike this balance of like, you know, doing things that people want to hear and also doing things that like get you going. You know what I mean?
Like, I know what you mean, yeah. I guess for me, and maybe this is just the academic Marxist in me that's struggling with this, because it's funny you should say Keith Richards, because my big kind of dichotomy of maybe, yeah, the old model, but then the horrors of the maybe newer model is, I don't know has anybody here seen the Grant Hart documentary, Every Everything?
No.
It's amazing. Everybody needs to find it, watch it. There was a version of the soundtrack that came out for Record Store Day, and the DVD is in there, if you can find that, because nobody bought that either. But for me, it's like the difference between Grant Hart and Keith Richards. So the documentary was shot Errol Morris style over 5 days of just... Grant Hart was the only person who spoke maybe once or twice. There was the director saying something off screen, asking a question or whatever, but that's it. And, you know, how much, you know, Grant Hart had some of the same issues that Keith Richards has or has had. And Grant Hart struggled unbelievably in his life.
You're talking about drug issues? Or?
Drug issues, you know, I think other psychological issues. You know, Grant Hart's house burned down a few years before he died because he was using space heaters because his furnace was broken. And the whole time I'm watching this, I'm thinking, you know, that really sucks. Grant Hart was an amazing, amazing talent, but he never made anybody else any money. If he had, he could have been Keith Richards. He could have been functional in his issues, but he never made anybody else any money, so he was always on the edge. And I also think, again, the Marxist in me thinks, how much creativity, how much product, how much whatever do we miss out on? And so I think it is this weird time that we're living through, you know, and it's like, how do people, you know, and I think some of those barriers of, how do I get into a band? How do I start shows? I mean, I think some of that is personal. But again, academic Marxist me always wants to think about the sort of societal, structural problem, you know. But yeah, fuck Keith Richards. Mm. Sorry.
Sorry. I mean, I love the Rolling Stones, don't get me wrong, you know. And he's very much a Rolling Stone. Mm-hmm. But I have known people who say things like, I want to buy my house off this band. And those are the most unhappy people I have ever known.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that, you know, to make, you know, in my position to make even somewhat more money than I do would be an unwelcome thing. Mm-hmm. I'm saying, you know, I would welcome it anytime someone tries to hand me money for music. I go, yes, thank you. You know, and I don't have any existential dilemma about selling it, you know. But if your reason for getting into a band is going, I want to buy a nice house in, you know, wherever. I want to have my library and stuff. You're missing the point, and you're going to be very unhappy. Those people across the board have been very, very unhappy. And they end up in bands that get big for a second and then disappear. You know, and that's the really heartbreaking thing.
Yeah. Well, there's the other thing too about just the notion of wanting to start a band and wondering how to do it is, I feel like at the time of my band starting, we, you know, we had a few contemporaries in our town that were kind of doing it at the same time, and you would kind of gauge people's perception of whether it felt like they were going to be doing it for a long time or not, just based on, you know, they would say like, oh, we want to go play in this town, but we don't want to play to no people. So, like, what are we going to do? And to me, it was always like, well, if your band just started playing, what reason is there for you to be playing to more than zero people? You know, like, right. That's kind of the whole crux of doing it is you're trying to start from zero and build your way up. So I always felt kind of like, well, what... Why do you expect there to be people at your show? You know, you've never played that place before. And then, the other thing too is I feel like there are people who have asked me, and I'm someone who I've been doing this for a relatively short amount of time, and I think just the fact that I've kind of made a conscious effort to just do as much as possible through the sphere of social media, just being busy to a lot of people equates to being, you know, successful, or like people have implied to me that they assume that I'm like making a living off of music, or I'm making a bunch of money going on tour. And it's just kind of interesting that I think when people just see a list of tour dates, they assume like, oh, he's
doing it.
Yeah, he's doing it. And it's like, it's very much not the case, you know? Yeah. But I think so. There's something that just maybe gets, there's some kind of a
disconnect.
Where it's, and I understand that because people are in different situations. If you have a full-time job and you maybe can't go on tour, I understand why that might seem like a huge, far reach from where you're at. But it is just interesting the way people sometimes can perceive things like that. And then I'll get like, and I'm not trying to act like I'm constantly solicited for advice, but every now and again, someone I know will ask me like, hey, how do you do this? How do you do that? And it's like, you just kind of do it. You know, there's nothing you can really,
you know, no one in my family. Okay. That's a lie. I was not encouraged at home to pursue a life in the arts. I was encouraged to pursue, you know, whatever you can do that makes the most money possible.
Yeah.
Because to be happy means to work till you drop at 65, and then if you want to pursue music, you can pursue music. I don't think my mother ever got over not being rich. But then I had wealth, you know, family that had money, and they said, you need to do what makes you happy. And I don't know, because they didn't encourage my cousins to do what made them happy. Yeah. My cousins all followed the parents' footsteps. So I think the reality was that the family saw that I was not a teacher or a scientist or a computer engineer or an accountant, that I had this other thing I had to go after. And they said, do what drives you in life and money will work itself out. And that has been the case. Like, I've always got enough to eat. Like, I've always got enough records, you know, I've always got clean clothes. Well, now I've always got clothes. But, you know, and I try to, you know, people ask me once in a while, I'll get the question like, Do you turn a profit on tour, or do you make money? Do you make a living? And I'm always kind of like, we try to eat, you know, like, but we do get, you know, we do get by. That I wish that the listening audience could see this dog, because this dog is way, way more compelling than anything we're talking about here.
But yeah, because I think, you know, as an educator, it's always for me interesting, because I mean, there is that phrase, Jeffrey Williams coined, you know, the pedagogy of debt, where, you know, people go to school and the promissory note, I mean, his whole thesis is the promissory note on the student loans that they sign is more informative than anything he can do in the classroom as an English professor. And I have that experience once a semester. A student just randomly shows up at my office and, yeah, there's maybe a paper to be written. There's stuff, there's schoolwork to discuss, but it's really about, you know, if I was an English major, my family would disown me. Like, literally, it's like, I want to do this. What I'm doing with you is so much more compelling than anything else I'm doing in biomechanical engineering, whatever the hell their major is. And they just look at me with this wild-eyed, like, either tell me this is not okay or tell me this is okay kind of moment that, I don't know, this economy that we're in kind of dictates.
I started college with the intent of getting a communications degree and moving on into broadcasting. And I realized in my first semester that you don't need... It's both an impossible school to get into at my alma mater, and you, if you want to go for a degree, and if you want to, if you want to work in the field of communications, you don't need a degree. Specifically in the field of broadcasting, you don't need a college degree to go into radio. You know, you need just, you know, you just need to have a clear speaking voice and know how to not cuss. You know, and you, it kind of, I think it kind of helps if you're dumb, but like the, or like vaguely creative but not actually talented in anything, you know. So I realized in my first semester that I wasn't going to continue in the communications field, and decided on an English degree, and I told my parents in front of the whole family, you know, including the people who were paying for it. So I there could be no like fight about it, you know. It was like, it was essentially like, you know, I don't mean to make light of coming out, but it was like a coming out moment where it was like it had to be done in front of every, you know, in front of the whole family, so there wouldn't be personal backlash, you know.
Or to like take them to a restaurant or something so they don't want to make a scene.
Yeah, well, that never stopped her from making a scene.
Yeah, I have a colleague who when she told her mother that she wanted to become a Latin major, her mother cried.
Yep, that's I believe that. I understand that. Yeah. It's funny. I've started, I think since the last time I was here, I've started painting. I was
That's right. We've talked about this.
I was selling drawings last time I was here, and somebody gave me a set of markers. I don't know if you know the origin story about why I Somebody gave me a set of markers. They were like, this is in the lost and found. We don't need it. Would you like it? And I was like, you know, hell yeah. I mean, I'd love that. And I didn't know. And I was about to go on tour. And I was touring on the bus at that time, on the Greyhound bus. And so I had nothing but time. And I just had these markers and I just started drawing. And over time, like, started developing, you know, technique and did that for about a year. And then about a year and change ago, I was like, I think I'm done with these markers. But what if I painted? And could I just start painting? Is there anything stopping me from just putting paint on a brush and putting it on a canvas with no training or ability? And it turns out there's nothing stopping me, so I started doing it, and then that's a whole other thing. Like, I can tell when I'm talking to somebody that actually paints, like that actually has an education, that they're being polite at best when I show them things that I've made, where I'm just like, this is what I do, and then they're like, oh, what, okay, you know, but like, as far as like this weird, you know, it's this weird secondary career below making music that's like, you know, because of the music, because there's a, you know, there's a if not success, then like a work ethic associated with what I do. There's been interest in it. Mm. And then one of the big differences between going around playing music and painting is that it's just like, I had to learn really quick that it's like, you can't just give paintings away for free. Mm. Like, and it was, went very quickly to being like, now they cost, like, now I charge for them, and anything I ask for them, pretty much people are like, yeah, of course, like, that's a bargain. Yeah. Like, I never get like, that's insane, you know, what's wrong with you? You know, if there's an interest from someone that in something I've done, like, they will kind of do anything that I ask for. And I find that really interesting, that like, music is essentially without value. Like, you have to hope to get on a big package tour with like Counting Crows or something in order to be, you know, in order to pay your rent. But
yeah.
But with the visual thing, there's still like a very deep and like, you know, both spiritual but also a financial value attached to it. And I wonder what the difference is. I think about what the difference is. Maybe it's the fact that this is one of a kind.
One of a kind. It's, well, you know, it's funny you should say this. Today is the anniversary of the suicide of Walter Benjamin.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, he died on this day in 1940. Couldn't get into Spain. Couldn't leave to escape the Nazis. And, you know, he's got that essay, The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction. And talking about how anything he recognized this in the 30s, you know, once you have mass media, everybody lives in a world of infinite copies. And to then have an original, right? I mean, I think you get some of that with the vinyl collecting thing. Ooh, first pressing or whatever kind of stuff. People, ooh, flock to that, you know, the rookie card or whatever of a band. Is a thing, but, you know, that impulse, if we live in a world of infinite copies, I mean, is that what it means to be starstruck? Is that what it means when you do go see one of those big shows and the singer casually mentions the name of the city that you're in and the place spontaneously explodes because, hey, I live near there, or something, you know, or, oh, he knows where he is, we're together, kind of moment.
First of all, if you go see a band and they don't know where they are, don't start a band, you know, like, let that inspire you to start a band.
Yeah, that's true. Though I will say the time that I was so lucky, I got to see Sharon Jones play at one of the county parks here.
Yeah.
She, for the first like three songs, was like, how you doing, Philadelphia? Oh, shit. And like, and then somebody in the band finds like, Sharon, we're in Pittsburgh. And she's like, it's all Pennsylvania. Yeah, it just kept going. And we immediately forgave her, and it was this beautiful, joyous thing that unfortunately will never happen again. But
you showed me a memo just before we get too much further. Why don't you read that?
I just said you can't download a painting. That's probably why it has more value than
not yet. Elon Musk will figure this out, right? I mean, Elon Musk will make paintings downloadable or something. If Steve Jobs hadn't died, we'd be downloading paintings right now.
He's
dead, so fuck him.
I go to Rough Trade every Friday.
Yeah,
because I know it's a corporate spot, but they have a good metal buyer. Like, they have a good, well curated metal section. And I go on Fridays and I look at the metal new releases at Rough Trade, and I usually buy something. I didn't the last time I went, but like, I don't understand any other method, any other. Look, I know you can download records. I download records all the time.
Yeah.
But like, as far as like, there's a difference between like, I don't know. You're younger than I am. Do you feel that way about music? I mean, do you have that kind of like attitude about it?
I've found myself at sort of a crossroads the last few years, because I do find it increasingly difficult to know what interests me or what or where to look for things that will interest me. So I've had a big sort of dilemma of what have I been doing differently from what I used to do when I, you know, even when I was a teenager and pirating music and stuff, that was how I, you know, came to love most of the music that I is now my favorite stuff. So I try to find some kind of middle ground between that side of it and, you know, obviously I still want to pay for things and I still want to own physical things. And, I ride that line in some way. But I do find, I'm not sure exactly what you're asking me specifically, but,
well, you were in elementary school when Napster became a thing, mm-hmm. you know, and people like Matt and I were, you know, are you used to going to, you know, I went to Harmony House on new release day.
Yeah.
You know, no, you knew from a postcard that yes. a new They Might Be Giants album was coming out, or the new Weezer or the new Primus.
Yeah.
And I, at the end of high school, I went on my lunch break at school and skipped lunch to go buy whatever new record. I mean, you ducked out on Tuesdays to go buy.
I think the oldest person in the room here, I had this mental block. Like, I have a hard time listening to stuff that I've downloaded. Like, if it's just a download only, like, I have a USB stick in my car, and now I have, for my 5-mile, 20-minute commute to work, 9,990 songs for my 20-minute commute to choose from in my car, or to set up on random and be surprised with the coolest radio station ever, you know, because there's nothing on there that's going to piss me off or that I don't want to hear. In that, it makes sense. At home, I almost have this, like, block. I mean, there's albums that I've bought and I've downloaded and I've never listened.
Yeah.
But there's very few records I could say I've ever bought and never got around to putting on the table at least once. And I, for me, it's like, it's almost the other extreme. Like, I have this block against, I need to hold the thing. And I think that says something also about, like, how do you make an experience tangible? You know, with that painting, I think is it that's, you can have a digital image of the painting, but that's the only way to have that experience, and it's tangible, is to be in its presence. I think for me, there's something to be said. And I like paying for music. I like, you know what, even if I don't necessarily love a band, if they have something cheap on their merch table, you know, I'll pass them $5, fuck it, you know, and like, give it another shot later. It's like, maybe I just caught them on a bad night, or PA was being weird, or no monitors or something, you know. I'll pass somebody $5 to $10 that reason.
I saw this band, so that's what I'm asking, is do you feel the connection to physical media?
Yeah.
That we're describing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have records and I have CDs and I have Spotify. And to me, the thing is, there's sort of a constant debate of if any of those things are inherently better or worse or good or bad. And I think, at least for me, they're all fine. I don't think Spotify is Spotify is dubious, of course, but once again, it's like, if I have heard of a thing that I don't know if I'm going to like it, I'm not going to spend $20 on every new record that I think I might enjoy.
Yeah.
And I only have limited space to store. So it plays a role, but, you know.
The radio's dead.
Yeah, I mean, I radio's something I've never had a huge connection to specifically anyway, but, yeah, I think it's just a matter of, you know, whatever works for you. But of course, I think the question that hangs over all of that is who's getting paid for the way you're consuming it, and that's, you know, where obviously Spotify is perhaps a lesser choice, but
go ahead.
I was just gonna say I tend to think that most people, at least who are in situations, who are music fans like we are I think understand that notion, and as you're saying about you'll throw $5 to a band you maybe didn't even like, I think most people that Brooke and I will encounter on this tour are sympathetic to that same idea.
I do kind of wonder sometimes how many people have bought my record because they really wanted it versus how many people have bought it because they not necessarily felt bad. There are some times where you're like, you play a thing and they're like, oh my God, like you play like the worst show of your life and they're like, oh my God, you're brilliant. Here's all my money, give me a record. And I'm like, I don't always think that's the real deal, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't always think that's...
See, I shouldn't have said that. Don't go there. Don't ask that question. That's not a good question to ask.
I don't ask people.
No, I mean, don't ask that question of yourself. Oh. I mean, no, just take the money. Cash the check.
Yeah. I mean, the money spends the same... Pity money spends the same way as admiration.
Don't even ask me if it's pity money. It's a genuine... I think it's even though, is it... Maybe this is maybe a more healthy way to frame it then. Is it that maybe you might not like the end... Like, the end result might not have been... But for me, that making that purchase is, I like your aspiration. I like where you're going. I mean, I think that's the other thing is we do also, if you want to think about artistry as a sequencing of records. And if you've, I think about some artists where I go, they put something out and I look back at the two albums before and I was like, oh, that's the direction they were heading. They hadn't gotten there yet. Right. And so is that also, I think for me, sometimes it is that it's also, yeah, that wasn't the best night, but there's something happening there. And I want a piece of that thing that is happening, even if it has not reached its destination yet.
Yeah.
So it's not a pity thing. I think it is these people are making something happen and I have disposable income to help them make, even if it is just when they're clear on whatever, is it a gallon of gas?
Right.
A gallon of gas means something.
Right.
When you're on the road. And I think for me, it's like, okay, they're headed to a place. I had that experience, or maybe the most recent way I've learned that lesson was I got to see Proto Martyr at this bar in Polish Hill called Gooskies, and they were the last band on, and I think there was 12 people left. Jeez. It was the end of the night and it was a work night, and it was before Agent Intellect came out.
Okay.
And I think I don't know if there were even monitors for that show. I don't know if they could hear themselves play, and the lead singer I think was still really deep into his stage fright, so he actually had the mic almost up to the ceiling and then pointed downward, and he sang into it staring at the ceiling like he wasn't ready to deal with even the fact that there were 12 people in a pool table in front of the stage. And for me, I was like, I heard three songs, and my friend was like, oh, you got class to teach tomorrow, fuck it, let's get out of here. And then thankfully there was a really great record store that kind of doesn't exist anymore called Soundcat. And I was in there, and my buddy Jason, who's been on this show many times, put Agent Intellect on. And I was like, what the fuck is this? Like, it was immediately exciting, and I was like, it was fall, and the world's dying, and that record sounds like the world dying, and that way that it's beautiful in the fall. And I was like, who is this? He's like, this is a band called Proto Martyr. And I was like, the fuck? What? And that record dominated... 18 months of my life. Just that was the thing I listened to, and yeah, and not like respecting the, oh, well, this is happening or this is what this band is going for. And it was like, respect the aspiration too of what people are going for, even if they're not there yet. And then the next time I saw them, it was completely sold out and the line was out the door, and people have these horror stories of driving 2 hours to get to the venue because there was no advance ticket sales and get turned away at the door. Oh, and God. Yeah. Yeah.
It's funny how things just...
And that was within 8 months.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. I, there's no rhyme or reason to it, what blows up and who it blows up for.
Yeah.
You know. So you can't really take it, you know. I've played really big shows and I've played really small shows this year. You know, yeah. Like the last tour, it was like we played to a packed house in Chicago, and in Baltimore, I played to a couple and Matt Pless and Pat the Bunny. And that was the whole, and he was like, yeah, it's going to be a small show, but I didn't think he meant no one, you know, like even the locals that he booked didn't show up.
Yeah, the last two house shows I've booked, nobody showed up. I felt such a shitbag. It's like, I bought a lot of food. You can eat the spread. There's hummus.
Food helps.
Hummus. Hey, guys, hummus. There's hummus.
Because sometimes you go someplace and nobody shows up and they don't even have that.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, that's what we were talking about in the car last night, is the difference between playing a bad show because the host didn't pull their weight, or playing a bad show because whatever circumstance at play didn't work out. So I will say to you, if you're hosting house shows that people don't show up for, as long as you're being a good host, for me as the traveling person, would not be as discouraged as if we showed up and you were like, yeah, all right, well, go do whatever, you know, just here's my living room, you guys can just do what you want in here.
Yeah, you know? At least have some hummus.
Yeah, it's there's definitely something to be said for that.
I played a used card, a vegan potluck at a used cardboard box store in Long Beach, California. Okay, so vegan potluck, used cardboard box store. Vegan potluck, I've heard that phrase a lot. I've never heard the phrase used cardboard box store. This place, the only business, the only commerce they had was they appropriated cardboard boxes from the garbage.
Oh my God.
We got to this place, all the whole way there, we were like, we're playing a used cardboard box store. And we were like, what does that even mean? And we get into the place, they're like, I don't know, but we're going to get fed because it's a vegan potluck. We get into this place and it's a squat, and their business method was they dumpstered cardboard boxes and then sold them as their business. Like, that was their whole business. It was like, get the underpants, step two, profit, you know. We traveled, we ate a lot of canned food at the time. We ate a lot of, like, you know, just like cans of corn and stuff. You put enough hot sauce on a can of corn, it feels like you're eating something. So we brought in a couple of cans of food. One kid showed up with a Tupperware of rice that was clearly old. And another kid showed up with this pizza box. And he dumpstered it. He goes, oh, I picked this out of the trash on my way over here. It had two half-eaten slices of pepperoni pizza. And he goes, no, it's fine. It's freaking. And we were just like, oh, my fucking God. Like,
oh, no.
And that's my entire, that place and the Hooters is my entire Long Beach experience. I've never been back there. When I hear a Sublime song, that's what I think of. Is I think of Lou Dog. I think of, you know, Brett, the sweetest guitar solo you've ever heard. And I think of those two places. That's the whole city to me.
Wow.
I hadn't thought about that place in years. Thank you, guys.
You're welcome. Well, on that happy note, I think it's time for the bottom five. But first, again, Hard Sell.
Metal Is My Only Friend, the sixth album from Brooke Pridemore on Brooke Pridemore Industries at brookepridemore.bandcamp.com.
And pre-order is still happening, right?
Pre-order is still happening. Happening until the 9th of November.
All right. And?
Rhinestone Busboy EP, jacobcmckelvey.com, which Brooke has informed me is an unwieldy URL to be sharing. And my band, The Countertops, I have a forthcoming, tentatively full-length release that we just kind of finished tracking, so that'll be next year sometime.
Cool. All right, so now it is time for the bottom five. Oh, and by the way, links to all this stuff will be on our website and all that stuff. But it's now time for the bottom five. And I think, Brooke, it's been a while since you've done a bottom five with a group, right? But the bottom five rule is someone asks five questions, a series of five questions that are related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. But since we have three guests, we can only have one answer. So you have to decide on an answer.
Huh.
So you have to talk this out and answer this question.
Okay.
As one. All right? Mm-hmm. So question one. Out of all the possible ways a person can die, what is the way you least want to die?
I would say by Unga Bunga. That's the only thing I can think of. Anybody else? Like what?
Yeah. I don't want to die by Unga Bunga for sure.
Just don't be doing a job you don't like.
Ooh.
There you go. I think Justin's answer is that's
the winning answer.
That's doing a job you don't like. That's good.
All
way
right.
More poetic than Unga Bunga.
Yeah, it's way more poetic than Unga Bunga. Right. Question two. And I guess this is the Gumby question. Name a film you would like to visit or live in permanently. Like if you could, the way Gumby would jump into a book and live in the world of that book. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Is there, if there's a DVD case or I guess a Netflix screen that you could jump into and like either visit the world of that movie or live in the world of that movie permanently, what would that film be?
Hey, Dad, we're in Pakistan. Now we can sew soccer balls together.
What?
That's from Freddy Got Fingered.
Oh, you're right. Right. Is there any ideas?
No.
Freddy Got Fingered.
I was going to say the... I'm not a fan of Los Angeles, but in the latter half of Punch Drunk Love, like the Los Angeles / Hawaii of Punch Drunk Love. Have you ever seen that film?
It's been a while.
But the technicolors that they do, that would be my answer.
Is that our consensus, or are we doing Freddy Got Fingered? Or?
Not doing
I don't
want to
live in Freddy Got Fingered.
I want to visit.
You can take that to the bank.
I want to visit Freddy Got Fingered.
Well, you can visit there.
Vacation,
you can visit
Freddy Got Fingered.
Freddy Got Fingered, then that's the winner.
Oh, no. Paul Thomas Anderson was the winner.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, what's that? Question three. If you could unmake any invention, what would it be? There is just something you can take out of human memory, out of existence.
The MP3.
See, the academic Marxists are right.
The Pono player.
The Pono. Well, I think that's happened already. Hey, buddy.
That was Neil Young's lossless MP3 player thing.
Oh, was that the thing he expected you to pay like $900 for to listen to?
No.
It, you know, for the privilege of listening to Neil Young. Like,
yeah, and I think like the one of the big tech magazines, like the one they sent to review it, like it broke within an hour. Mm. I think it was CNET. They were like, yeah, the screen broke after an hour of use.
Yeah, Jesus. It was not a well engineered product, I don't think, from the outset.
It was also shaped like a doorstop.
Yeah.
It was a triangle-shaped wedge.
Yeah, it's like a Toblerone.
Yeah, it was a big Toblerone that played music.
It reminds me of that season of The Office when they're trying to market the Saber tab, or like the tablet that's a triangle, the shittiest fucking,
yeah,
you know, terrible interface.
It was like that, yeah. I never saw one. I never
saw one in person, but
Yeah.
As anybody?
No.
Maybe it doesn't really exist.
Yeah. It's like just an urban legend. It's like the Tucker.
The Tucker exists. There's like 40 of them.
Yeah. And those were nice. Those worked.
I love the conceit in Christine that it's a different Tucker. It's called the Tucker Talisman.
Yes.
And nobody knew about him because they only made two of them.
Yeah.
But that was what Christine was, an evil. Yes. The evil independent, the evils of the independent auto industry.
Yes. But wouldn't it be nice to have a car that could heal itself?
Yeah.
I mean, there were times when I was in grad school, I was like, you know, my car could kill people, but as long as I didn't have to buy a new alternator.
Yeah. That would be an even exchange.
Yeah.
Well, every car could kill people.
But like on its own.
Yeah.
Like its own, of its own volition.
Anton Yelchin's car could kill people on its own.
It's true.
Jesus. I'm sticking with the MP3.
Any objections?
I'd just like to say that Matthew Broderick's car could not kill people.
Yes. All right. Question 4. If there is a hell and you end up there, name one celebrity that you expect / hope to meet.
Matthew Broderick. The world needs to know about his car accident in 1987.
You know about this?
No!
Apparently Matthew Broderick and Jennifer Grey were in a car in Northern Ireland and he swerved into the wrong lane of traffic and hit another car head-on and killed both passengers in the car and was fined $175 for reckless driving.
Wow.
And that was how the world learned that Matthew Broderick and Jennifer Grey were dating.
Wow.
Yep.
Pouch. Wow. Sorry, you know, it was funny because we just went not long ago. There was a special screening of Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And we're like, let's go see Ferris Bueller. And now that Dad and, you know, Hero's having all these fine nostalgic memories of like, you know, oh, wasn't it great? Like a world that wasn't completely fucking falling apart. Like, wouldn't that be nice if you could just like play hooky and have a nice day in the city and not worry about shit? But apparently that was a myth and that's over.
The world was falling apart then. They just did better at pretending that it wasn't.
Mm.
It was.
It's morning in America.
Yes.
Yeah.
Fucking right. Anyway. Matthew Broderick?
I was going to say Gene Simmons, but I don't hope to meet Gene Simmons anywhere.
What could be that you expect? That could be the expect.
Gene Simmons is a good choice. I was going to say, we were talking about Chevy Chase last night.
Oh, yeah, he is a monster.
Yeah, but he's kind of resurfaced recently, and I'm beginning to sympathize with him a little bit. I would like to talk with Chevy Chase.
Yeah, I feel like the at the bottom of the crisis with him, because I did the you got to really look for it, but you can see like the roast, the Comedy Central roast of him, where none of his friends showed up and his comics just tore him apart. And they keep cutting to the same reaction shot, you know, where like they don't even show him on camera. And
what year was this?
2002. Stephen Colbert was not yet he didn't yet have the Colbert Report, because he was one of the ones that really, like, his career took off from dragging the fuck out of Chevy Chase.
It's like Anthony Jeselnik.
Right. So I would concur with you that you know, his downfall is that he doesn't realize he's a prick.
Yeah.
Like, he genuinely doesn't understand that he's, like, an ass.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
That if his behavior was better. And so, yeah, I'd go with you on that. Because I'd say Lee Hazelwood, but Lee Hazelwood's not in hell. But, yeah, I'll go with Chevy Chase.
All right, last one. We're almost out of the woods. What is your least favorite month? There's only 12 to choose from, so that shouldn't be too bad. Not too existential.
August.
Mm.
I'm going to agree with that. That's a pointless month. It's just to serve some Roman politician's vanity. Yeah. What's next? Trumpist?
Ooh.
Trumpist.
Trumpist. Yeah, August is just hot and stupid.
There's no holidays.
Yeah. You're just hot and stupid all the time.
I still let myself, like, I associate August with fall, though I know it's never fall. So I still, like, have a tendency to assume I'll enjoy August, but rarely do. I was going to say March, but I'll hop on the August bandwagon here because it tends to suck.
Word.
Word. All right.
I think it didn't even take any convincing.
Yeah. So I think that's about it. Our next episode will eventually happen, and it'll be about something. Our homepage, where you can find new and old episodes, is gonnadiepodcast.com. We're also on iTunes, Google Play Podcast, Stitcher, TuneIn, Podcast Addict, and Mixcloud, when I remember to upload it to Mixcloud. We're also, follow us on Twitter at gonnadiepodcast, and We're All Gonna Die is on Facebook. Thanks to Brooke and Jake and Justin, and of course, there'll be links to all the fine things that they do on the podcast. And thank you to Andrew Fox for our new theme music.
Word.
Word. Later, meets.